You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
Investigations will continue this morning into the murder of a man in Cork City. Timothy Hourihan, who was originally from West Cork, was beaten to death. He'd been living in a tent on Mardyke Walk. Katrina Toomey of Cork Penny Dinners, which provides food and support to homeless people in the city, is in our Cork studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
You knew Mr. Hourihan. This must have been a really sad and disturbing weekend for you.
Yes, it is. And we're deeply saddened and we're hurt by it all. And this is where we're going to stand firm now and plead with, I suppose, our Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, to step in and to do something. We're losing too many people. There's too many people on our streets. The homeless crisis is really over the top. We've been talking about this for years and we've been telling the government that something needs to be done. And this, you know, what happened over the weekend has caused untold grief for a family out there again, and untold grief amongst the homeless community. But when we're talking about the homeless community, we're not just talking about the rough sleepers, the people that have to sleep out that can't get in anywhere. We're talking about the people that are in B&Bs and in hotels, the families. Very little is being done. And now we know that it's, we're going to lose more people because of the government's lack of interest in this problem, in solving the problem. It can be done. There's a workable solution out there, and we would appeal again.
When you say, Katrina, that there is a workable solution out there, I know homelessness has become more and more of a problem in Cork in recent years. What, in your view, is the solution?
It's not just housing. We need treatment centres and we need support services. The people that work in the support services here in Cork are very good, but they're all stretched. So we need a lot more. You have people going into treatment centres and they come out and they're homeless again. So how can that help them heal? Do you know, the whole situation has to be looked at and we've got to put a full package together. We have a revolving door. It's the same for when people come out of prison. They're back out and they have to present at the homeless services. So again, they may commit another crime to get back into the prison just to have some place to stay. And so if you're looking for a solution, the government needs to sit firm with those at the front line. They need to listen for once and for all to what we're saying, and they need to put that plan in action. But they need to be doing it now. We're not talking about next year or the year after, because every year we come back with the same story to the government. Please solve this problem. We need it solved, we need it sorted, and we need it done now.
I know you don't want to dwell on the circumstances of Mr. Hourihan's death, but no. Can you tell us a little about him, and also can you tell us about the area where he was living? Are there many people sleeping there?
There are a lot of people up there, and I suppose they went there because it's off the beaten track, so to speak, very near the city so that they can access services, but it is off the beaten track and they probably felt that they were safe up there. Again, when you have a load of people staying in one area, that can be a recipe for disaster in itself, you know, because people have a lot of frustrations going on. They have a lot of difficulties. There's a lot of issues going on. And you can't just leave people hide themselves away. We see the fear and the frustration. We see the tears. We see it all. And they're totally frustrated up there. And they're wondering how long more they're going to be there. They're actually in a field like that's waterlogged at all times, because it just, the rain will just soak the whole place. So can you imagine having to, you know, be there night after night after night? And the less visible they are, the less visible the problem is. So the government, you know, aren't looking at it. But we see it and we feel it.
As you probably know, that money isn't the issue here. No. That there is money for whatever needs to be done. So in the short term, I mean, I know many people will have been shocked by what happened at the weekend. In the short term, what can be done?
There are lots of houses for sale around the country. Buy them up, put the families in there, start freeing places up. There is a huge amount of money being paid to the hotels and the B&Bs for the families and for individuals that are in the hotels and B&Bs as well. And that money could be freed up to buy housing and use more money like that the government would have to buy any houses that are out there for sale. There's for sale signs on houses all over the place, turnkey, and people could move in. We have to look at more hostels, but smaller hostels, you know, that are easier to manage and not to be lumping a load of people together, whereby all with different issues and complexities like are all together, and that again could be another recipe for disaster. You end up managing it and controlling it rather than moving, using it as moving forward, you know, and helping the person that's in there. So we again need smaller hostels or smaller, you know, complexes for people, like, you know, apartments, you know, one bedroom apartments for those that aren't ever going to be married or have a partner or, you know, have anybody with them. There's a huge shortage of that, and something could be done. There are buildings around the place where there are apartments. Right. So we would just urge the government to, you know, and the Taoiseach to lead us out of this at the minute and to look at the state of our mental health and at our addictions and the underage drinking. Everything is boiling over here in Cork, and it's very hard. And the Gardaí need more resources here in Cork. They're appealing all the time for that. So do the medical services. And they're appealing and appealing and appealing. And that shouldn't be happening. Oh, These are our frontline services that should have what they want and what they need.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us this morning. That was Catriona Toomey of Cork Penny Dinners.
The country's third largest airport, and up until recently was on an upward growth trajectory, but Shannon Airport is experiencing turbulence. Last year, 1.7 million passengers used the airport. This year, that figure is likely to be significantly lower. The grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX alone has cost the airport 120,000 passengers, as airline Norwegian cut its transatlantic routes. And last month, Ryanair also announced it was cutting three routes as part of a wider cost-cutting programme. So what's the future for Shannon Airport? Our reporter Tommy Meskell has been finding out.
We've experienced growth from 2013 up to the end of 2018, where we saw passenger numbers in the airport rise by 34%. The current year, we've seen the impact, particularly the grounding of the MAX jet and the impact that has had, where we lost 13 weekly services over the summer period. But we would be confident when we come through the current turbulence that the aviation sector is in, that would be back on track and we would see that trajectory growing into the future.
For continued climb.
It can cause a rapid change in altitude and direction, so it's no surprise that Mary Considine likens the past year to turbulence. She's CEO of Shannon Group, responsible for operating the state-owned airport.
Well, the fundamentals of route development are all about demand. So the more business activity and the more tourism activity you have in the region, that creates demand for services.
Shannon isn't operating at capacity, is it?
Well, Shannon Airport has terminal capacity of 4.5 million passengers, so we're operating significantly below capacity at the moment.
Shannon has the largest runway in Ireland capable of landing a space shuttle. It's also a diversionary airport, facilitating 95 emergency landings just last year. The airport has opened the Midwest to the world and even the stars, welcoming the likes of Marilyn Monroe and every US president since JFK.
John Travolta is a regular customer of ours, which is lovely.
The general manager of Dromoland Castle, Mark Nolan.
Clinton and Nelson Mandela, who came to stay with us for two nights.
And many of those people, would they have flown through Shannon?
They would have all have flown through Shannon.
But celebrity aside, Shannon Airport, just 15 minutes from Dromoland, is essential for business.
But what we really need to do is get sustainable European connectivity. Dromoland Castle, we have a huge North American base of our business, but we could even grow that, and the region could grow that business, if we had better European connectivity, because a lot of North Americans will travel into Europe, do a couple of days in Europe, and backtrack through Dublin and through Shannon. Right now, we have no real European connectivity.
On the edge of County Clare is the village of Doolin, home to Anthony Maloney, owner of the Doolin Hostel.
The hostel, we started off in 83, longest family-run hostels in Ireland, but sadly in 3 weeks' time I'll be closing it. Why? Because Shannon isn't working properly. People, like last night, all my guests were from America. So in the next 24 hours, they're all going up to Dublin to leave. because they couldn't get the flights out. So their first and last day is just about getting access into Ireland and staying. And it's great, you get the day tour down, it creates a job, but for every job that it creates, we lose the potential of 20 other jobs.
It's a day trip. We're actually staying in Dublin, and so we took a tour here.
If you were planning your trip again, do you think you might like to stay a bit longer here in Dublin?
We would get a bread and breakfast here. We wouldn't go to Dublin at all.
Did you know that there's an airport here in County Clare?
No, we didn't know. Mm-mm.
Dublin isn't a one-off example. A recent report by Copenhagen Economics has found what many have been saying for years. Ireland's economic development is unbalanced. It also finds that aviation policy plays a big role in helping an area to grow.
Katrina Cahill, Chief Economist with Limerick Chamber. The report that we commissioned from Copenhagen Economics in association with Enis Shannon and Galway, we asked them to look at how aviation policy impacts the economies of the West and the Midwest. And what they found was that if you think about Dublin's dominance in the market at the moment, they have somewhere between 86 and 87% of the market share. If you compare that with European countries, the only other small economy similar to Ireland where you see a higher level of market concentration is the Netherlands. But you expect that because Schiphol is obviously one of the most significant EU hubs. The interesting thing, though, is that in the last 10 years, whereas Dublin Airport has increased its market share, Schiphol has actually reduced its market share. If the significant dominance of a capital airport continues, it hinders growth in the regions and it goes against their goal of balanced regional development.
Northern Trust in Limerick employs 1,400 people. Catherine Duffy is its Senior Vice President.
So we're a financial services firm. Our HQ is in Chicago, so we have a lot of people to and from Chicago. We also have a big office in London and a lot of offices throughout EMEA. And we want people to come live in the region, work in the region, have fun in the region. You know, we say here we have a city job and a country life. Shannon is 30 minutes up the road. It's very important for us to keep it going.
Extension of passengers travelling on Aer Lingus flight to London Heathrow.
Heathrow Airport is currently Shannon's only European hub. Brexit could reduce that connectivity to the EU. It's another potential problem for Shannon.
Today, even absence of Brexit, we need connectivity into a European hub. There is very, very strong demand for connectivity today into a European hub.
As part of the budget, a new fund of €2.5 million has been announced by the Department of Transport for regional airports and ports to help them secure new routes. It will be made available next year. Shannon will have to compete with other airports for part of that funding, but it's potentially a chink of light.
It would be support to the airline to underpin the service and provide that connectivity for business and tourism, and that will be very, very important in the context of Brexit.
And that was Acting CEO of Shannon Group, Mary Considine, ending that report by Tommy Meskell. The Tánaiste has raised concerns about the citizenship and identity provision of the Good Friday Agreement after a Derry woman lost a challenge by the British Home Office on its ruling that she is British by birth. Emma D'Souza from Maharafelt in County Derry sought to get a residence card for her US-born husband, making the application to the UK's Home Office as an Irish citizen in keeping with the Good Friday Agreement, which allows all people born in the North to identify as British, Irish or both. But the Home Office argued that she is automatically British by birth and, if she wishes to renounce it, she must apply to do so, and yesterday won their case. Here she is talking to Mary Wilson on Drive Time on RT Radio 1.
Well, I'm understandably devastated and disappointed by today's decision from the tribunal. And the requirement of me is now that I accept that I'm a British citizen. And the process is that I have to renounce British citizenship. In order to do that, I have to actually declare myself as British and prove that I'm British and pay £372, give up freedom of movement for 6 months, and after which I actually could be exposed to deportation from Northern Ireland, because I've seen cases where people have renounced and then their status to remain has been called into question by the Home Office. But really the core of this is the fact that I'm not a British citizen. I haven't held a British passport. I haven't accepted British citizenship. And I understood that the Good Friday Agreement gave us an explicit right to identify and be accepted as Irish or British or both. I'm Irish. It wasn't a choice or a decision. It's simply who I am.
That's Emma D'Souza speaking to Drive Time yesterday. Patricia McBride is here. She's a lawyer and political commentator working in Derry and Dublin. Patricia, thanks for coming into us again. Just to read out the relevant section of the Good Friday Agreement, it's page 3 under the section Constitutional Issues. It says the participants endorse the commitment made by the British and Irish governments that in a new British-Irish agreement replacing the Anglo-Irish agreement, they will recognise the birthright of all the people of Northern Ireland to identify themselves and be accepted as Irish or British or both as they may so choose, and accordingly confirm that their right to hold both British and Irish citizenship is accepted by both governments and would not be affected by any future change in the status of Northern Ireland. What's the significance of what happened yesterday in your view?
Well, there are a number of significant elements to what happened, and I think one of the first is the fact that the Upper Tribunal has separated the issues of identity and citizenship, and this isn't something that we've seen before. Identity for all of us is an innate and unchangeable characteristic. It's who we are. Citizenship is the outward manifestation or the formalisation of that identity, and so now we're being told that those two concepts are separate, and I think that that's something that will form a very strong part of the basis for appeal to the Court of Appeal, as Emma and Jake D'Souza have indicated will be their next course of action.
So as far as the Home Office are concerned, you can identify yourself as Irish, but if you're born in the North, you're British. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, and I think that that's the difficulty. You're British first, you're Irish second, and that's a difficulty for a number of reasons. First of all, because there are a significant number of Irish citizens living in the North who don't, never have identified as British and never would seek to assert that British citizenship. And the second issue is now that it creates a difficulty around around negotiations on Brexit in terms of the future relationship. Because first of all, we have a situation where the Taoiseach in December 2017 affirms Irish citizens in the North will never again be left behind by an Irish government. Well, how do you ensure that if your partner in the negotiations is saying, well, those aren't Irish citizens, they're British? And for the British government, it binds their hands in the sense that based on yesterday's ruling that Irish citizens in the North are British first, well, then they would be creating a special class of British citizen in order to ensure continued EU citizenship rights for those Irish citizens. So it's a very challenging position that the British government and the Irish are being backed into at this point.
Why did the British Home Office challenge Emma D'Souza's citizenship?
Well, the issue is simply around the initial application for residence on behalf of her husband as a under an EU treaty rights process where as a national, as a citizen of Ireland resident in the United Kingdom, she was entitled to apply to exercise her EU treaty rights. Why they've chosen to challenge that when the reality is that I would suspect there are a very limited number of cases in terms of that type of situation that come, that are made every year. The only thing that can that one can surmise is that this is indicative of British immigration policy, which has become more and more stringent over the last number of years. As an example of that, people who have currently been granted refugee status in Britain are now going to have their cases reviewed every 5 years, and if it's felt that the situation in their country of origin has changed, then they can be returned to that country despite having perhaps created family ties in Britain, had children there, children in education there. They can now be returned after a 5-year review of their case. So there has been a hardening in immigration status, and let's face it, the reason Brexit happened in the first place, one of the key reasons was around Britain taking back control of its borders and not permitting nationals from other countries to live there.
Patricia McBride, thank you for coming into us. That's Patricia McBride, a lawyer and political commentator working in Derry and Dublin.
European Union leaders prepare to travel to Brussels today for a crucial summit on Brexit, not knowing if there'll be an agreement for them to ratify, despite intensive negotiations over the last few days. As we know, the focus of those negotiations has been on Ireland, Northern Ireland and the border. With our Europe editor Tony Connolly reporting that a deal has been done on North-South customs arrangements and giving the Northern Ireland Assembly a role in consenting to those arrangements. This morning, though, has come that statement from the DUP that that it cannot support that agreement as things stand, but that it will continue to work to try to get a deal. Let's talk to Tony Connolly, who's on the line now from Brussels. Very good morning to you, Tony. First of all,
good
perhaps
morning, Brian.
I can ask you about the response there, reaction so far, or likely reaction to that DUP statement this morning.
Well, the reaction publicly and privately would be that this is a matter for the UK. The European Union doesn't negotiate with a political party or even the House of Commons. It negotiates with the UK state. If Boris Johnson has to get political parties to come with him, then essentially that's his problem. I mean, we are back where we were in December 2017 when the joint report was poised to be agreed between Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker, and the DUP pulled the plug on it when they realised what was going to be in that deal. And that was extremely embarrassing for Theresa May. But this time the stakes are a lot higher because, as you say, we've got EU leaders coming to Brussels in a matter of hours. Some of them may be here already to endorse an agreement that is not yet concluded. And there was considerable irritation yesterday, to put it mildly, that we were in a situation where leaders were going to be getting a legal text at the very last minute without their capitals and their experts having time to go through it, and then being expected to take a major political leap in the dark to endorse this text. It's also worth saying, Brian, that yesterday it was made clear to me by quite a few sources that the consent and customs issue had been agreed between the EU and the UK at around lunchtime, and that text was stable. And throughout the day, that text didn't change, apart from perhaps a few tweaks here and there. So it was stable on the basis that the UK felt that they could sign up to it. If the DUP are now saying they couldn't, then that suggests some kind of breakdown in communication or keeping people in the loop in the Westminster system. If the DUP are now saying that they can't accept these customs and consent arrangements.
And I do want to ask you to just explain in outline, if you can, in a moment, what those arrangements, proposals would involve. But just first of all, on this VAT question, because that emerged yesterday, did it as an issue? Has that been resolved, or is it close to being resolved?
Well, we don't know if it's close, but that did emerge as a last-minute problem. If Northern Ireland stays in the EU's VAT regime, then you're going to have to create some kind of mechanism to manage VAT on goods going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, because the UK will be in a different, or Great Britain will be in a different VAT regime. Although what I was hearing yesterday was that there were workarounds for that. It may be that the VAT issue is something of a fig leaf to cover the problems and the disarray over the consent and customs issue. We simply don't know.
Right. So EU leaders sitting down for their summit later today to get it underway. They don't at this stage, we think, have a final text. And if they have, they haven't had a whole lot of time to look over it and to examine the legal implications of it all. We have a DUP rejection of key elements of that deal and presumably continuing uncertainty whether the United Kingdom government can get the deal through Parliament, even if it gets to that stage of the weekend.
Yes, I mean, this whole process is now fraught with uncertainty and anxiety over the process. As I say, EU capitals have not had a chance to go over this legal text. And they, you know, if this agreement is endorsed, it comes into effect in a couple of weeks' time. That's an international legally binding treaty that binds everybody into the future, and it comes into effect in a couple of weeks' time, and leaders are expected to endorse it in a couple of hours' time, and they effectively haven't seen it yet.
So explain to us then, if you will, what the proposals would mean in terms of customs arrangements on the island of Ireland, and how it would address this issue of the border.
So the plan as outlined does remove any need for a customs border on the island of Ireland. Northern Ireland would be in the UK's customs territory, but it would be applying EU tariffs and rules and procedures. So that means goods coming from Great Britain to Northern Ireland would face potential customs tariffs and checks and controls. There is also going to be a regulatory border on the Irish Sea for goods going to Northern Ireland. They would have to comply comply with EU safety standards and agri-food standards and so on. But on customs, even though there is a border on the Irish Sea, there are going to be quite a few exemptions. Now, there's going to be an automatic exemption if you're just travelling and you have your personal effects with you back and forward between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. There would be exemptions, for example, if you're moving house and you have big ticket items in moving house. Now, in terms of all the other goods and food products and so on that might be traded between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, there may be other exemptions down the line. If it can be guaranteed and if everybody is absolutely certain that those goods are going to where they say they're going, in other words, they're only going to Northern Ireland, they're not going to enter the EU single market over the land border. Now, how do we work out which categories of goods will fit into this exemption? Well, we don't know, because it is going to be worked out by the Joint Committee, which is a body set up by the withdrawal agreement anyway. They will have to sit down and work out a schedule of what kind of goods get the tariffs and checks and what kind of goods don't get them. There will also be a potential rebate if there's a differential between the UK and the EU tariff. But goods that, say, sugar that make part of a wider package, they will face tariffs and controls.
So you can see why the EU27 might like a bit more time to look at the detail of this. And that's not even to mention the proposals in relation to consent, giving the Northern Ireland Assembly a say, but presumably addressing this concern that, the Irish government, among others, had of the possibility of a unionist veto over these arrangements.
Yeah, so the consent mechanism is, again, pretty complicated. So we have a transition period which ends at the end of December 2020. At that point, these arrangements come into effect and they will last for 4 years. Now, at the end of the four-year period, Stormont gets to decide, are they going to opt out of these arrangements? Now, they have to decide what method they use to take a vote to opt out. So you have two options there. One is you have a simple majority. Now, that is seen as less favourable to the DUP. If that simple majority votes to stay in the arrangements, then everything stays as you were. But 4 years later, there will be another opportunity to have a vote on staying in. If, however, Stormont decides to go for what's called a cross-community majority, which is more favourable to the DUP, people say it's akin to a veto. If the DUP take a gambit, or a gamble rather, and go for that particular method of a vote, cross-community, closer to a veto, then if they fail to get support to exit these arrangements, then they have to wait for 8 years before they can do it again. So it's kind of it's a bit of a gamble for the DUP to go for the method that is more favourable to them. Now, crucially as well, if the Stormont votes to opt out of these arrangements, then there's a two-year cooling-off period during which all sides have to find a workable solution to avoid a hard border and maintain the precepts of the Good Friday Agreement. And at the end of that, if there's no solution, then the protocol lapses. And we are back in a hard border situation. But just to finish off the point, at any time, if Stormont collapses during that process, then the default is that the protocol stays and we stay in these arrangements.
Well, I can see why they'd like more time. I'm tempted to ask, do you get to phone a friend at the end of all of that? It just does underline the complexity and the detail that's involved in any agreement in this area. Tony, listen, thank you very much indeed for that. We'll no doubt be talking to you in the course of the day.
The United States Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, has issued a fresh warning to the British government that there will be no trade deal with the United States if Brexit undermines the Good Friday Agreement. She was speaking at an event in Washington last night where she presented US Congressman Richard Neal with a Lifetime Achievement Award on behalf of Irish American Democrats. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan was there.
There was a distinctly Irish feel in Washington, D.C. last night. Congressman Richard Neal was honoured with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Irish American Democrats. The organisation's president is Stella O'Leary.
It is indeed fortuitous for Ireland that with the looming threat of a chaotic Brexit, Congressman Neal has attained the chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee.
The Ways and Means Committee is in charge of trade deals, and Richard Neal has repeatedly warned that there will be no such deal with the UK if Brexit undermines the Good Friday Agreement and leads to the return of a hard border. It's a warning that's also been issued by his boss in Congress, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
Our Speaker, our friend, Nancy Pelosi.
Fresh from her latest battle with President Donald Trump, Speaker Pelosi was at last night's event to present Richard Neal with his award. She spoke about the importance of protecting the Northern Ireland peace process.
So many Americans were a part of the Good Friday Agreement. It represents our values, and we have no intention of it being weakened in any way.
After accepting his award, Congressman Richard Neal recalled a visit that he and Nancy Pelosi paid to Ireland and the UK earlier this year.
When she visited London, when she visited Belfast, Derry and Dublin, she gave the same message, that in her judgment, the Good Friday Agreement was sacrosanct. It could not be compromised. And under no circumstances could it be abandoned to the Brexiteers. Yeah. We were sitting with the Brexiteers at lunch, and one of the Brexiteers, and I was mentioning that earlier today, laid out his view of Brexit. And as he laid out his view, I was sitting next to the speaker, and she pointed out eloquently that there could be no bilateral trade agreement with the UK if there was any jeopardy offered to the Good Friday Agreement. Yeah.
Because I have a friend on the Ways and Means Committee.
Yourself and Richie Neal have been very vocal when it comes to Brexit, trade deals. What's your message on that topic?
Well, our message to the British government is don't be misled into thinking there'll be a UK-US trade agreement if the Good Friday Accords are violated. Good Friday Agreement is violated, and that means a backstop at the border. So we all be watching very clearly, and we delivered the message with Richie and our delegation when we were there, and we deliver it to any visitors who come. And I must say that some of the British have taken it quite well.
Former Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams was at last night's event in Washington and praised Nancy Pelosi and Richard Neal for their support of Ireland's Brexit position.
I'm very minded of when they went in that delegation to London, to Dublin, to Derry and to Belfast. They made it very, very clear there would be no trade agreement between Britain and the USA if there was any undermining of the Good Friday Agreement. And I think that's a sense of the power of Irish America.
What are you hearing back home in terms of the negotiations currently underway, and what's your assessment of what's going on right now as we speak?
Well, I'm minded not to say too much because it's not over until it's over, and the devil will be in the detail. What I know is this: nothing good will come out of Brexit for Ireland. Nothing. There is no good in Ireland coming from Brexit, whether it's soft landing or harder landing, whatever way it manifests itself. It is not good for the economies north or south. It's not good for our social structure, and it's not good for our Good Friday Agreement and for the human rights elements of it. I don't believe for a second that Boris Johnson isn't aware of the consequences for Ireland. The truth is, he doesn't care about the consequences for Ireland.
Something he certainly does care about is a post-Brexit trade deal with the US, but there were plenty of warnings last night that that may not happen.
There won't be any trade agreement if they violate the Good Friday Agreement.
That's Nancy Pelosi there with her warning once again for the British government, ending that report from Washington. US astronauts Christina Koch and Jessica Meir will make history today when they conduct the first ever all-female spacewalk. They're going to replace the power source on the International Space Station and will spend a number of months then in space. We can talk to space commentator Leo Enright. Hi, Leo.
Good morning, Audrey.
This was meant to take place, I think, earlier this year. Why has it taken so long?
Well, it's a good question. Women have been going into space since the early 1960s. The great Valentina Tereshkova was the first woman in space. But it took the Americans many, many years after that to launch women. Now, fortunately, we're at the stage where there are simply enough women going into space that it becomes inevitable, and today is the day, when two women will step out of the space station in these spacesuits. They're basically small spaceships of their own, and they'll spend 6 or 7 hours outside the space station doing some very, very serious construction work, repair work on the station. This is hard, physical work.
And you mentioned the spacesuits there, and wasn't that critical as to why this didn't happen back in March? Because the spacesuits weren't designed for a woman's body.
That's right. This has become quite an issue. When you look at the design of the International Space Station, all sorts of small details, when you look at them, you realize this was designed by a man. And the spacesuits are the most dramatic example, but there are many others. The problem back in the early part of this year was that all of these spacesuits are really very old. Some of them have been on the space station for 20 years. And we got to remember, the space station itself has been in orbit for 20 years. So they're running out of spacesuits, and sometimes they just don't have the right sizes.
Yeah, and when I remember back in March when NASA said they were postponing the female spacewalk because of the spacesuits, Hillary Clinton tweeting, make a new suit. But as you say, you know, all of these things, whether it's chair heights, temperatures, even ladder rungs, it's all designed for the ideal man in mind rather than gender equality.
Yes, I mean, there's no question. There's a great deal of gender bias in the designs. Things are definitely improving. We have to acknowledge that. But the spacesuits are a particular problem. Hillary Clinton, as you say, quite sensibly said, you know, build more. But actually, they don't have the technology and the knowledge anymore to build these spacesuits. They're actually built by women, largely women, in a factory where they sew them together. These things are handmade. And as I said, largely by women at a factory in New England. But they haven't been building them now for 20 years. So they've lost the skill to build spacesuits. And now there's a panic on because the Americans are talking about going to the moon and landing women and men on the surface of the moon. Suddenly, they've got to design new spacesuits and build them.
And Leo, will this also be an opportunity to observe the effects of space on a woman's body? If these women are going to spend a number of months in space, this will be an opportunity to do that.
Well, certainly. And we have to remember that a great many women now have been living and working on the space station. We built up between the Europeans, the Americans, and sadly the Russians. It's quite interesting. The Russians haven't launched a woman into space for a considerable period of time. But the Europeans and the Americans are now routinely launching women to the space station. And these women are spending long periods of time on orbit, which is definitely building up the database that we need. So that we can plan for those long missions, for the time when women and men go on the long journey to Mars. Okay. They'll have to be willing to spend 3 years in space, and we need to know how their bodies, the bodies of women, just as much as the bodies of men, how they cope with this long period of weightlessness.
Thank you very much, Leo. As always, great to talk to you, Leo Enright.
Now, as we've been discussing on the programme already, tomorrow morning Ireland line out against the All Blacks in Tokyo in our quarter-final clash in the Rugby World Cup. Ireland has never progressed beyond the quarter-final stage in the competition, but has chalked up two recent victories against the mighty New Zealand, following decade after decade of defeats. So, how does the team prepare for tomorrow's clash, and what in particular are the psychological challenges facing this Irish team at this stage in the tournament and against this opposition? Well, Dr. Stephen MacIver is a sports psychologist and a former Ireland and Munster player. He's with the studio. Very good morning to Stephen.
Good morning,
thanks
Brian.
For coming in to talk to
You're
us.
You're welcome.
At this stage of their preparation, just what, 24 hours or so before kickoff, what space should the Ireland side be in?
at this stage there should be a calming effect coming into the team where they reinforce their messages from the management into the players, and crucially from the leaders in the team to the rest of the team. So once we have cemented the role clarity, what way we want to play, and it was interesting to listen to Eddie O'Sullivan talking about the fact that maybe we need to expand our game plan, that can cause a little bit of dissonance or confusion with the players. So it's embedding those messages into the players, understanding their roles is prime to this, and then understanding the individuals, knowing, doing those roles and their emotional control and psychological planning and preparation.
I mentioned the fact that we have these two recent victories against New Zealand, and that presumably is important in instilling a belief that we can beat them.
100%. And even Conor Murray talking about New Zealand today about they're just human, you know. So we have an advantage that we're still rated as underdogs, which we do excel under. But that anchor, that belief that we can look back and we have beaten them, gives us a wherewithal and a drive. The key issue is getting that balance where you don't slip into an element of, okay, it's okay, the work is done. So there's that element of fractiousness is useful to the performance. But having those anchors of success are instrumental in their performances as well.
Just a word about the performance of the team up to this, pretty mixed in the pool stages. Now, how do you put that behind you as a team? How does Joe actually get them to leave that aside?
Most of that will be down to restructuring their thinking, looking at the positives that they have done. Absolutely what you said, Brian, looking back at New Zealand. Also, you can see the messages coming out from the team. This is a one-off game. So they're trying to limit any residual impact from those recent poor matches. And probably the most influential of those recent matches was the warm-up match against England. Such a destruction to us would have bitten down an awful lot in our confidence levels. So now they're going to look at this match purely on its own, not even looking at the semi-final, but looking at this one opportunity to go and drive home their advantage against New Zealand.
Inevitably, in any particularly at rugby at this level, there will be players who, for various reasons, won't be kitting out. In the case of Ireland now tomorrow, Bundiaki won't be there because of the match ban. What kind of a blow is that, and how is that dealt with, particularly when it's a key player like that?
He is a key player, and we had talked before the leadership within the team really are the people that run the team when it comes to the game. When it comes even to the preparation, the warm-up, you will see Schmidt on the pitch obviously giving instructions and guidance, but it's the Sextons and those players. And that's where Ireland have a real forte. They have a spattering of really cohesive team spirit over many years of successes, and then you've got the likes of Johnny Sexton, Rob Kearney's experience at the back that really controls the emotions and regulates the focus from the players. And that could stand for us because, as Eddie O'Sullivan actually said, whilst you have phenomenal athletes within the New Zealand team, they lack experience. And that experience comes to tell when pressure comes on. So if Ireland plays a very pressure game, if the weather helps us, then those guys are going to have a lot of questions and they mightn't have the experience to step up.
So on the one hand, maybe if I'm interpreting you correctly, there's an element of talking down the opposition. I don't know if that's quite the right phrase, but you know, trying to put them, you know, in terms of the context of their performance. On the other hand, you don't want to underestimate the challenge you face.
100%. And knowing the assiduous attention to detail that Joe Schmidt brings, they will be letting go the result because it's a distraction. So they will be pushing away the expectations and increasing the pressure on their roles. So they will have a defined role in every part of the game. They'll have a strategy and there'll be actually an excess pressure. But as Schmidt and many coaches will mention, it's uncontrollable factors. Once you have a role clarified, you can actually increase pressure and it can be useful to your performance. It's the distractions of the results, mistakes, those things that pull from us.
And what about the ebb and flow of the game? I mean, we were talking there, Teddy O'Sullivan, about how you let the All Blacks off the hook and they can have a couple of tries over the line in no time at all. So in that kind of situation, what kind of preparation can there be for players to say, actually, we're still in this battle?
They would often, most teams at this stage would plan for contingency training or stress inoculation training, where they would create scenarios and replicate those scenarios, and they would put them in scenarios, you're two scores down, you're 5 minutes into the match, and then they're going to deal with how do we tactically deal with that, but also how do we mentally deal with that, how do we emotionally come together as a team and then condition ourselves to be able to overcome those stressors.
Stress inoculation training.
How's that done? Well, basically we, and you can see it coming out very evidently from Eddie Jones, who's a a top-class coach, as good as there is. And the English players are talking about, when they come to a game, they're actually quite happy because it's less stressful, less demanding, less speed, less intensity, less combativeness than they face in training. Mm-hmm. And it's like anything in life. If we get conditioned to something, then it becomes easier.
Do you want to call it finally, Stephen?
It's such a tough one. I do think the leadership within the team, which is instrumental, is stronger in Ireland. And I think with a little bit of rain, a little bit of luck, and a pressure game, I think New Zealand could crack and Ireland will nip it.
Okay, let's hope you're right. We'll be watching tomorrow. Thanks for that. That's Stephen MacIver talking to us about tomorrow's quarterfinal match.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.